we're entering the third year of this terrible tragedy in this country. And what's happening is that because people's purchasing power, lack of salaries, lack of factories or jobs being available for people, civil servants not being paid, that's on the one side. And on the other side, we have many restrictions on importation, the banking sector, the economy's on its last legs. So people are struggling on both sides to actually be able to buy food, to be able to afford to buy food and feed their families. And that's why you've got 7 million people in this country who don't know where their next meal's coming from.
When it comes to painting a vivid, compelling and honest picture of Yemen's suffering, one voice more than any other has stood out when it comes to reporting what's been going on there. That's Jamie McGoldrick, until late January, the humanitarian coordinator for the UN in Yemen, speaking to UN News on the phone from the capital Sana'a in early 2017. In the thick of it for more than 2 years, his simple aim was to ensure as many civilians as possible got the support they needed to survive, caught between Saudi-led coalition forces and Houthi rebels who've been assisted by Iran. I'm Matt Wells, and for this latest edition of our UN News interview podcast, Jamie McGoldrick reflects on his time in Yemen, leading the team that millions have been relying on across the country, operating under ever-changing wartime conditions. With few reporters able to gain access to Yemen for months now, he's felt a special responsibility to get the facts out without fear or favour. He's helped to keep Yemen suffering in the headlines, despite bouts of deep frustration that the war was being forgotten and the world's attention was being consumed by other conflicts and humanitarian crises. We spoke by Skype while he was still in the Yemeni capital, and then again a few days later on the evening he left the country. More on Jamie's thoughts about leaving later in the podcast. When we first talked, late on in January, he began by describing the UN setup in Sana'a.
We work out of a UN office. There are a few UN offices here, but the main one, which houses a few agencies, UNDP, OCHA, and the likes, is in an area called Hada, and it's quite close to where we have our own accommodation compound. The office itself is quite large, and it's sort of spread out. And the buildings are very low. The top flat is two stories, so it's quite a low thing. So quite well laid out. We are well served because we have solar panels and we have generators, so we don't need to rely on anybody else for that. But the office setup has a good mixture, a good balance of international and national staff, and both male and female. So it's quite a good 50-50 office in that regard. So it turns out a lot of products and turns out a lot of support from Sana'a to the northern part of the country as well as to the southern part as well.
So Jamie, just in general terms for listeners that don't know a lot about Yemen and how we've got where we are today, I mean, what essentially has gone wrong?
It's a very poor country. It's the poorest in the Arab states. And the poverty is endemic, and people have never really had any governance of any kind in some parts of the country. They live without government. There's very much local tribal politics. There's been a recurring sense of, you know, foreboding and uncertainty. There's been clashes, there's been tribal fighting, there's been political parties against each other. At one point in time, there was two parts to the country, and it was unified. And there's been a series of coups. And then there was a national dialogue process by key donors, key governments. And at the same time, the UN was very much involved in that with a special envoy. And then the Gulf Cooperation Council also had their own initiatives as well. So this national dialogue process, which is very consultative, was meant to then mend all of those differences and overcome the political challenges. But I think what it didn't do was actually address the root causes. And the root causes were sort of lack of governance, sort of the imbalance, power, resources, and the access to those. And I think this, the way the country is divided up with so many places missing out on any development possibilities there. And because of that, they then came with a result which was meant to be a new way forward. And some of the parties rejected that new way forward. And included in that was the Houthis. And at the same time, President Saleh, who was the previous president who stepped down, he then was out of the political fray as well. The South was very unsettled in the sense of there was a lot of dynamics, people hanging back, looking at the previous time when they had a southern Yemen and a republic there. And so there was a lot of grievances that were not answered through the national dialogue process, which is often the case. And so as a result of that, there you had Saleh and the Houthis deciding to take power in the capital and then driving out the legitimate president, who then fled to Aden and ultimately to Riyadh. And since then, there's been this sort of attempt to try and get the government of Yemen, legitimate government, back in place. And included in that was a resolution 2216. And with that came a Saudi-led coalition, which was made up of a number of countries in the region led by Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, to try and change the political dynamic and change the political face back to what the national dialogue wanted. So since then, that political stalemate and the military campaign has resulted in the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
You're not a diplomat, but what are the chances of there being a political solution to end this war during 2018, do you think?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I think the recent Hodeidah port, which was as part of a blockade that the Saudi coalition put in place once the 4th of November missile went into Riyadh, they closed all ports. I think there was a massive advocacy effort by the UN and by key capitals to push back on the Saudi coalition and let them see that by doing this, all you're doing is exacerbating the civilian tragedy and the humanitarian dimension of this. And they then, I think, relented and opened up the port for 30 days. So I think there's clearly a case where people can listen, and I think that's important. I think also at the same time, with the change in the situation in Sana'a, with Saleh and the whole GPC, the political party, the People's Congress Party, which is no longer as part of the alliance, but not as of solid as it was, that has changed as well. And I think there's also changes, as we know, underway in Riyadh as well. And all of that lends me think that there's things that are moving, maybe not always in the right direction, but things are moving. As long as things are moving, you've got spaces to operate. I think the international community and the key donors who are involved in there's a makeup of something called the Quint, which is a group of member states, the Emirates, the Saudi Arabia, the UK and US and Oman. They sort of oversee the political economic side of things here. I think there's new political dynamics that could come to play, including the European Union and some key member states who are non-aligned, such as the Germans. Those changes might spark people to rethink the fact that they've done over 1,000 days and not really gotten anywhere militarily and certainly not got anywhere politically. So I would say that's where the optimism comes from. And if you couple that with the understanding of how desperate the situation is here, when the rial versus the dollar is the lowest it's ever been. In the last year, it's lost 130% of its value against the dollar. The casualties in civilians are massive. You know, the cholera outbreak, as well as this current diphtheria outbreak, these are clear signs that of systems failure, both economic, water and sanitation, health, and all of that is collapsing. And if at some point in time when reconstruction takes place, as it will, it will be the same actors in the region and the Gulf Cooperation Council and the Western states who will come in to support this. And if they let things collapse completely, it's very difficult to resuscitate.
So as the UN humanitarian coordinator, what are the headline facts and figures that the world needs to know about the conditions that Yemeni people are living in right now?
Every year we've done the humanitarian response plan, and this is the third one. Every year it's got progressively darker and deeper in terms of misery. We're currently now having to address the needs of 22 million out of 29 million people who need some sort of assistance that they can no longer look after themselves. Within that group, there is a population we are trying to target who are the most vulnerable, which is 10 million. And that makes up the ones who are unable to feed their families on a day-to-day basis, who have no salary of any kind, whose purchasing power is nil. And they live on negative coping strategies, from begging to selling assets and everything else that goes with that. If they have to make stark choices. If a sick child in a family of three or four is there, they have to use the medicine on that sick child, and the other children will then starve. Or do you let the sick child die? And these are choices that are made on a regular basis throughout this country. We have no fuel on a regular basis. The price of fuel has gone up by 100%. We need fuel to pump water. We need fuel to deliver water. So we're making people very much at risk to a repeat of cholera when the rainy season comes. And so I think these are all the regular things that people face on a daily basis. And what's happening is that, you know, the prices of, because of the price, the currency rate has gone, and because of the blockade and the difficulty of bringing goods in cheaply, importers are passing those prices on to goods, to individuals. Speaking to some people today, and they just tell you, we just have one meal a day now. and that's people who are working. We have one meal a day because the salary they had for their family, that same salary is now spread over 3, 4, 5 families, and so they're all cutting down more and more.
And what kind of daily frustrations do you and your team face in trying to alleviate some of this suffering and trying to bring the aid and relief that does come into the country, try and distribute that to the people that need it?
Well, I mean, it's like in any conflict zone, the things you face are the classics of access. The other one is the actual insecurity itself and being able to ensure that you can get from A to B without being caught up in ground fighting or bombing, shelling or airstrikes, which are, these are all very commonplace. And normally these are in places where we have to try and access populations to deliver food or non-food items or vaccination campaigns against diphtheria. So there's an access challenge and a security challenge. There's also a resource challenge. I mean, we had an appeal that went out last year for 2017, which was for $2.1 billion. We only got up to around 70% of that. This year it'll be difficult because there'll be more people who will be requiring assistance, and because of the price hikes and the ability to bring in goods easily, all the costs incurred with delivering food and delivering assistance will be much more expensive, so there'll be less money available for more people needing to be served. So we have that constant battle of trying to work out who's the most vulnerable, how do we work out targeting. And then the other classic problem you face in types of conflict is the interference, which comes with the selection of beneficiary and the delivery of goods to certain areas controlled by certain factions or certain groups. And that's something we face. And there's also, because of the political nature of the crisis here, there is interference politically as well.
You personally have been criticised, haven't you, by some aspects of the political leadership?
Yeah, I get criticised on a regular basis, but I think that's accepted. I don't use any information that's not verifiable, that's not been given to me by sources from NGOs and UN agencies present on the ground. I travel the length and breadth of this country and I've seen what's happened and I see the way that people are suffering. I'm not here to make up stories and try to politicise humanitarian assistance or the lack of humanitarian assistance. I can see quite clearly what's going on. I know what the causes are. I know who's behind it and who's responsible. It's my job to try and alert the world to what's going on, because the international media is not allowed into Sana'a in the north because the Riyadh controls the airspace, and the only flights that come in are the UN flights, ICRC and MSF, and the manifest for passengers are scrutinised. They have to send in advance of 48 hours, and journalists are not allowed to fly into the country. So that's why, in terms of media, international media, it's very much a black zone, a black hole. It's my job as humanitarian coordinator to try and raise the profile by doing more and more interviews than probably I would normally have to do if media was here themselves to ask their own questions and tell their own stories.
So what's your coping strategy for dealing with that kind of pressure and that kind of responsibility?
Well, I think a couple of things is pragmatism. And, you know, the fact you've got a job to do, you do it. And it's got to be done. There's a team here that needs to be you to work with and to direct and support and supervise, both within the agency and across the whole international community. And we have a very solid team here, both in the international NGOs and national NGOs and UN agencies. And we're very well placed, I think, to serve the needs of the population. We're very, I think, the fact that we're delivering assistance to some 7 million people in food and up to 10 million people in health support, it gives you a sense of positive, a sense of success.
Well, at that point, the line to humanitarian coordinator Jamie McGoldrick broke up. The days that followed were especially busy as he prepared to leave the country. We agreed to talk again after he'd flown out of Yemen. When he spoke to reporters at the airport on the 24th of January, he praised the spirit of the place and its people.
I leave Yemen with a great deal of mixed emotion, I think. Sadness because of the suffering that's taken place. Frustration because I haven't been able to do more for the people of this country. And at the same time, more and more people have become vulnerable because of the crisis. It's time that this was over, because even the strongest people, they have only got so much they can offer before they get broken. And right now, they might be bent, they might be buckled, but the resilience and the spirit of Yemen is not broken yet.
Later that night, having reached Jordan, we got back in touch and he reflected on the crisis he'd just left behind in Yemen.
Politics have failed humanity yet again. I mean, the muscle that was needed to put behind the actual political process was indifferent, inconsistent, and it just ended up in a complete stalemate, and the failure of politics just exacerbated an already catastrophic humanitarian situation.
So did you just decide that there was really no more you could usefully do? What's the reason for your departure at this time?
Well, I mean, it's a combination. I mean, the fact that, you know, these places you're expected to do around 2 years. I've been there for more than 2 years. And then it's also about, you know, what else comes up that you can move on to, which is relevant and appropriate. And a couple of jobs came up around this time. And so I'm moving to another one, which is something which is obviously very interesting too. So I could have stayed on in Yemen a bit longer, I suppose. But I think that when you start to become part of the architecture and you start to become part of the problem where you spend a lot of time transactional costs and dealing with criticism that comes your way, and it's diverting attention away from the real reasons why there is a crisis and the real reasons what the crisis has thrown up. So I'm leaving, you know, in a very positive frame, because I think we're able to achieve a massive amount of work there as a humanitarian community, both international UN agencies and NGOs and the national NGOs and staff that work for this. I think the appreciation that I've had this week from all the people, interlocutors I've met, both from the media, civil society and the authorities in Sana, they're very well pleased, and they acknowledge the success of the work we've done and the lives we've saved, and that was our job. So I'm leaving on a high despite the sadness and the despair in many ways and frustration.
I mean, do you have any regrets looking back on the last few years?
I could have done more sort of reaching out to Riyadh from the humanitarian point of view, but I always saw that as a very political dynamic. And we tried to do it on a very technical basis, and maybe I should have invested more time in that. I'd have liked to have set up more of our staff in, you know, outside the capital and the hubs closer to people, but for security reasons and other reasons we couldn't. And especially in Aden in the south, I'd like to have had established a sort of a bigger presence than the current one we have, which is about 30 international UN staff, which is, that's grown in the last 6 months to 30. We didn't have any there 6-9 months ago because of the security situation is still not stable, but we are trying our best to sort of invest in time, invest in people in there to try and bolster the southern part of the country, where despite the fact that it's occupied by the Saudi-led coalition, there's still significant humanitarian needs that we've seen through the humanitarian needs overview and through the response plan that we've developed actually covers all of those areas. So there are pockets, significant pockets of malnutrition, health and water and sanitation crisis in those areas. So I'd like to have had more capacity and more presence in those areas. And around Taiz, which is one of the frontline areas, if we could have had a different relationship where the both sides meet and look more at the humanitarian rather than get caught up in the military control and the lack of access, that became difficult. But for by that, I don't have any regrets whatsoever. In fact, I'm very pleased with the way the country team, the humanitarian country team, is in a very coherent, unified, and I mean solidarity and, you know, empathy is something that we exude, plus the whole notion of humanitarian principles being our sort of big push to weave a sort of a good path through very complicated landscape.
I mean, are the challenges of delivering humanitarian aid and are the demands simply overwhelming at this stage for any entity or any combination of entities, you know, the UN and partner agencies to be able to deal with?
No, I mean, in the last year, I mean, we were able to build up our ability to address sort of physically about almost 90% of the population. We were strapped from resources because we were only sort of almost 70% fund of our appeal last year. I think what we'd also say is that, you know, we were able to deliver regular monthly assistance to some 10 million people. And that included, you know, 7 million people receiving food rations or food vouchers or cash. And that plus water and sanitation support in terms of water being delivered to 4 million people, health up to about 10, 12 million people. We cope with the largest humanitarian crisis in the world. We cope with the largest cholera outbreak in the world. And I think all of that's a testament to how well-functioning the humanitarian country team is, both national and international. So I think that it's in very good shape. If it got more access and it got certainly more resources, we could do an awful lot more.
You said as you left Yemen that the spirit of the Yemeni people has been bent and buckled, but the spirit's not yet broken. I mean, is there a danger that that point might come fairly soon?
Well, I think we're already starting to see signs of it, you know, one, because people's assets which they've had, you know, land or houses or apartments or whatever they've had, they've sold those off. And then you're getting child marriages much, much younger. You're starting to see gender-based violence growing. You're starting to see child recruitment and accelerating. And then, you know, the whole negative coping strategies are starting to kick in as well. So I think we're coming to a point in time for more and more people who are on the edge. I think it's a physical thing, it's a psychological thing, it's a financial thing. And at some point in time, it will just crack or break or snap. And other people around them who would have been normally able to, you know, accommodate or catch them as they fall, I think they're also struggling as well. So I think we're getting closer and closer to that. And at the same time, you've got this wave of malnutrition coming because people are on a hand-to-mouth. 8 million people who don't know how to feed their families every day. It's a day-by-day existence.
I mean, you said earlier that you're going to leave with great memories of Yemen. Is there one particular memory that you think will stay with you the longest?
I saw an IDP camp up in Hadja and Abs, which was made up of very desperate people who'd fled many times to flee to escape fighting in the northern part of the country, had gotten there, had been removed from one camp to another camp. And then you saw the way that nationals absorbed them where they could. And then you saw the international community come in with some good NGOs providing water and sanitation. Then you've got a UN agency with a mobile clinic. Then you've got you know, food coming as well. So, I mean, when you see things like that, when you've got 3 million people displaced and you see that we're able to do that kind of thing, and that's happening all over the country, I think that's fantastic. You know, there are stories of individual children. I saw a child when I was in Nib, and she had fled coming up from Mocha, where there was an outbreak of fighting earlier in 2017. And she fled with her family. Her parents were killed en route. And she got with her brother and herself, and she ended up in Nib. She was shot in the leg, and the brother was completely traumatized. And then we were able to help them in such a way, get them psychosocial support, give them, you know, move them from the living in a damp basement to a proper displacement camp. You know, those kind of things stick out as being things that are successful for us, but we're against the clock, and we're against the numbers, and we're against the resources.
The stress and the tension that you and other aid workers in your situation must be under is negligible, I guess, compared to the suffering of the people themselves. But I mean, how do you and your colleagues cope with that, with the kind of daily pressure that you've been living under for the last 2 years?
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, it pales into insignificance when you think of what Yemis have to suffer. We know this is a terminal thing for us. We'll always leave at some point, and we can get out. I mean, the people in Yemen who are trapped because of poverty, trapped because of the crisis, trapped because the airport doesn't work, as well as the airstrikes and the ongoing shelling and the indiscriminate fighting and the ground fighting and the instability, I mean, that's all there. We've got release valves. We can decompress. We live in decent accommodation. We've got electricity and water, and you know that's all there. How can we complain about what we've got? Okay, it's stressful in a way, but I mean, these are the kind of environments that if you choose to work in, you have to accept it. And I think most people who do work in that environment do accept it, because we look to our national colleagues and we look to the average Yemeni. They're stress levels are 10 times ours can be.
They're going back to living in the same conditions that they're trying to help alleviate.
There's a lot of well-off Yemenis and political leaders throughout the country who survive because of they've always had wealth, and the gap between poverty and richness is, like in any country, is massive. And in Yemen, in a war economy, it's massive ever still. So, I mean, we have to recognise the fact that, you know, a lot of the colleagues that we work with are probably at the higher end of benefits than the ones who we serve as IDPs or as people who are completely powerless and to control how they're going to survive and, you know, feed their families.
How do you stop yourself from just getting angry and a bit disillusioned with it all?
Well, I mean, I think it's an easy way out to get disillusioned and get angry. I mean, you get angry because of this, of the failing of the system, and you know, the politics has failed again. And you get angry because the numbers grow each year, and you get angry because there's people living and dying silent death throughout this country, not directly because of the war, but because of that there's no services there to save them from health or water and sanitation. They're drinking rubbish water. They're not getting served because there's no health centre, and they can't afford the drugs that come in. The drugs are not there. The doctors don't get paid salaries, so they don't turn up. So you get a sick child, and somebody has to make this choice between, do I feed my family or use the money and then use that to treat the sick child? And you know, and as a result of that, you can't do both because the other children get sick. And so in corners all over Yemen, there are children and old people and sick people dying silent deaths, and they're never even counted when it comes to the deaths and the fatalities of this crisis. And I think that's the sad part. And so there's no point in getting angry. There's no point in getting frustrated. It's just a point of getting smart and just trying to work with all the people you can and work with the authorities, despite them. You might not like them, how they work and how they operate, but at the same time, they are there and they have to, you have to work with them to get a partnership to facilitate access. And hopefully with the access, you get the resources, and all the resources, you get the chance to save people more and more. And this is our biggest challenge, to be honest.
Has this been the toughest job of your career so far?
It's probably the most interesting job I've ever had, the most challenging job. I mean, I don't think it's tough. I mean, I think it's just a challenge. And I think it's been a fascinating challenge, and I've loved every minute of it, to be honest with you. And despite all of the sort of headaches that you get with it, I think given the results we get and the people we have to work with and the way we serve people and the success we have in terms of that reach, I'll never forget Yemen because of the work and because of the people.
What's the advice that you'd most like to hand on to your successor at this stage?
I mean, be prepared to battle, be prepared to fight, and be prepared to understand the culture of the people and see what you can do to help them. Try and get people to stop building barriers and trying to get people to understand we're there as humanitarians for humanitarian purposes based on principles. We're not there despite funding we get from various member states. We're not there to carry out an agenda. So I think all of those things, I would say.
Well, Jimmy McGoldrick, thanks very much for your service to the UN in Yemen, and all the very best for the future.
Thanks a lot. No problem.
Jamie McGoldrick from the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA, having just left one of the most difficult and demanding jobs there is in the aid world right now. This is the UN News Interview Podcast. I'm Matt Wells. Thanks for listening. We'll be bringing you more in-depth stories and interviews very soon. You can find our main podcast, The Lid Is On, and other interviews and features on our UN News SoundCloud page. Go to soundcloud.com/UN Radio.